Dr. Geller reviewed many of the surgical aspects of management of hepatic metastases, and I met with Dr. Eric von Kutzum for his take on systemic therapy issues in these patients and an update in other areas of research in the field. Dr. von Kutzum began our discussion by commenting on the workup of patients with liver-only metastases.
You need in these patients a high-quality spiral CT scan, but we also do a PET scan in these patients. If PET scan is available, and nowadays it's available in many places, a PET scan helps us to select better the patients. We, from our group in Leuven, have also published a couple of years ago the additional value of PET scan in this group of patients. There are also some other studies in this, and we have shown that in approximately 10% of patients, by adding a PET scan after a good quality CT scan, you can find some extrahepatic disease that changes the treatment plan. The PET scan is not to characterize the liver metastasis. The PET scan is to detect some extrahepatic disease so that you can select better the patient, so that the outcome of the group of patients that are operated is better. So that's mainly to select out extrahepatic disease.
You know, of course, things like age and comorbidities are obviously going to be factored into the decision. But in terms of the specific factors that determine whether this is a resectable situation, is there anything that you need to know other than the location and size of the lesions in the liver?
The location is important. The size on itself is not important. What is important is that there is no invasion of the different vessels so that the surgeon can do a resection. He can remove a large part of the liver, but you need to keep in place 30 to 40% of the liver parenchyma. If you have to take out 80% of the liver, that's not going to work. But there are special techniques like with venous embolization so that you can have a hypertrophy of the contralateral lobe after a few weeks. That's sometimes done, but that's really specialized surgical techniques. And if a patient, and that's an important aspect also, a patient who received a long-time chemotherapy, we know that chemotherapy can give some side effects. We know of the problem of steatosis on one hand and steatohepatitis, and on the other hand also sinusoidal dilatation. And we know that the complication rate after liver surgery in patients who receive preoperative chemotherapy is related to the duration of the chemotherapy. So in other words, if a patient receives 6 months of chemotherapy, we see that there are more postoperative complications than in a patient who received 3 months of chemotherapy. That has been shown nicely also in some studies from the two different groups from Paris, from René Hanau and Bernard Lorlinger, this duration of treatment and complication rate. And that's because the chemotherapy with longer time on chemotherapy gives some liver changes, some damage, some steatohepatitis, mainly related to irinotecan, or some sinusoidal dilatation, more related to oxaliplatin.
And your group presented some information on that at this meeting last year. I've been trying to figure out sort of qualitatively what the difference is, particularly functionally and complication-wise, in terms of irinotecan pre-op as opposed to oxali?
That's a very difficult question. The group of Vaute from MD Anderson has said that, as described, and has published also some data. And data published by Vaute haven't been confirmed by all different groups. And it's difficult to give any qualitative and especially quantitative numbers.
Do you have any sort of gut feeling in terms of which one is worse?
Yeah, my gut feeling is that both are very similar. And that's also what we state in that paper. And also the findings of groups with a lot of experience. What is probably more relevant is the duration of treatment. The longer patients are treated, the more complications. That has been shown in several publications also.
Can you comment on the EORTC study that was presented at the ASCO meeting last year looking at this?
The ERTC study was a study in patients with initially resectable metastasis, where we gave the patients a fixed amount of 6 cycles or 3 months of FOLFOX before and after the operation. And where it has been seen and shown that the progression-free survival of patients treated with the approach of perioperative chemo was better than patients who underwent surgery alone. we've also been looking at complications, and there are slightly more complications in patients that received preoperative chemo and then underwent surgery than patients who underwent surgery, straightforward surgery. So slightly more morbidity, but no difference in mortality. That's an important point. The postoperative mortality was identical. And then also last year at this ASCO GI meeting or GI Cancer Symposium meeting, Catherine Julien from Paris, from our ERTC group, has presented also some histologic data looking at the patients. What they did is with a couple of pathologists looking blinded without knowing to which group the patients belonged. And it was seen that there were slight changes in patients with oxaliplatin, slightly more histologic changes, which can be correlated with the slightly elevated complication rate. But this was acceptable. And I think an important point in this is also the duration of the treatment, which was 3 months. And in these different studies that I highlighted already, there was a clear cut of if patient got longer treatment than more than 3 months of treatment, then it's clear that the complication rate goes up. So this gives some important clinical messages. Patients with initially unresectable metastasis should be operated on as soon as they become resectable. The chemotherapy should not continue until maximum response, but if a patient becomes resectable, then the metastasis should be taken out. One reason is the complication. The other reason is that if we continue to treat, it might be that we don't see the metastasis anymore on the scan. And then for the surgeon, it becomes what surgeons call almost a nightmare. Maybe that's an overstatement, but surgeons call that it's almost a nightmare because it's then extremely difficult if they don't have a correlation on imaging to find the lesion. And the group of Dr. Norlinger has published also in the Journal of Clinical Oncology that even if you don't see anything anymore on CT scan, and if you take out that zone, that in more than 80% of the zones where there was initially a metastasis, but then nothing is seen anymore on CT scan, you still find microscopic lesions. So that means that you don't have to treat until everything goes away on CT scan because there is still microscopic disease. And the other argument is the duration of treatment and the relation to complications.
Right now, if you have a patient who's younger, you know, 55, 60, who has what appears to be, you know, straightforward, surgically resectable liver mets, are you going to send him to surgery or do neoadjuvant systemic therapy?
We give him most of the patients neoadjuvant systemic therapy with FOLFOX based on the ERTC study. There might be some exceptions. Patient, for instance, who got resection of the primary tumor 5 years ago and now who has one solitary small metastasis of 1 centimeter or small, easily resectable solitary metastasis. So long time after the operation, we know that this is a group of patients with an extremely good prognosis. That's a different group. But in most of the patients where the metastasis, the liver metastasis occur at the same time of the primary tumor and when you take out the primary tumor, or within a short, relatively short time frame, or when there are several metastases present in the liver, but resectable, one lobe, 3 metastases, for instance, we go in these patients for neoadjuvant chemo, FOLFOX surgery, and then again 3 months of chemo.
Now, the ERTC study, the patients in the one arm got preoperative therapy and postoperative adjuvant therapy, and the other arm they didn't get either. So how do we know whether or not the preoperative therapy is necessary? In other words, maybe you could accomplish the same thing just with adjuvant therapy.
Formally, there is no proof that the strategy of the perioperative treatment is better than only postoperative treatment. You're completely right. There is no formal proof. But when we designed that trial, we developed that concept also based on the fact that at least in Europe also at these days, and now also in the US, in rectal cancer and in many other cancers, we know that preoperative treatment has several advantages. It's better tolerated, and then there are the oncologic advantages. But formally, there is no proof that the perioperative strategy with pre- and postoperative chemo is better than the postoperative strategy. And this was one of the statements also Nick Petrelli did when he was discussing at the ASCO meeting last year. Dr. Petrelli suggested to do a randomized trial to develop these two concepts. But I think that's extremely difficult to do that, because just on a statistical basis, if you have to design, it's a non-inferiority approach probably, because you can't say that one of the other is better. So I think there are more important questions to ask, to address, to make progress for the patients.
He actually was sitting in that very chair yesterday saying the same exact thing.
Okay, so that's good that we agree.
What about the issue of biologics as part of neoadjuvant adjuvant therapy in this situation?
That's under investigation, of course. Biologicals can potentially improve the response rate, and we know that there is a correlation with response and resection. We don't have many data from randomized trials. We have the data from the CRYSTAL study, in which patients were randomized FOLFIRI or FOLFIRI plus cetuximab. And we saw that more patients with initially unresectable disease on the arm with FOLFIRI cetuximab could undergo resection compared to patients only with FOLFIRI. So that's one aspect. With bevacizumab, we don't have so much data. There was an exploratory analysis of the study presented by Jim Cassidy and Len Saltz of FOLFOX or XELOX plus or minus bevacizumab, where also it has been reported recently that more patients could undergo resection of the metastasis. This is a bit in contrast with the concept that I just told, that there is a correlation between response rate and resection rate, because in these FOLFOX, XELOX, plus or minus bevacizumab, the response rate was identical in the arm with placebo and in the arm with bevacizumab. But it might be, we don't know, that the quality of the responses is a bit better when bevacizumab is given. So that's not clear. That's an area under investigation. But I do believe, since biologicals increase, let's say, the activity of two cytotoxics, that especially and for sure in this group of patients with initially borderline resectable disease or liver metastasis only but not resectable, that if we give these patients two cytotoxics, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, it's probably not a big difference.
Let me just ask you one related question, which is the issue of imaging in patients who receive biologics. And he actually, I guess, had a series where he saw, like, in the liver, maybe the tumors kind of almost getting bigger when they were being treated. I think that was with Bev or something.
Yeah, especially with bevacizumab.
Maybe there was some swelling or something, I don't know.
Well, with bevacizumab, you see maybe not really swelling, but you see changes and sometimes necrosis in the center of the lesion, and so that you have the impression that there's less decrease if you just use the classic RECIST criteria.
Right. We did a seminar a couple of days ago on GIST. And they were talking about the fact that, you know, you can completely wipe out the tumor in the liver and yet it's still there on the imaging.
Yeah, that's why in GIST especially, the PET scan is extremely helpful. In GIST, there are data that if you do a PET scan after a week, that this will help you to predict
right.
the outcome. I mean, if you do, for instance, a classic CT scan after 2 or 3 months with imatinib in a GIST tumor, you might not see a lot of changes on CT scan or even small
right.
increase in size. But if you then do the PET scan also, you see a complete decrease in the signal, in the activity.
I heard people talking about sort of RECIST 2 or something, or kind of rethinking RECIST based on biologics.
Yes, there's still a lot of work to be done, but response criteria, RECIST and WHO, the classic criteria, are for sure far from optimal when used, especially for angiogenesis inhibitors and also for other targeted agents like in GIST patients and imatinib treatment.
So I'd like to shift the conversation to a discussion of biologics and therapy of colorectal cancer. And I thought maybe we could start out talking about EGFR inhibitors. Panitumumab, cetuximab. From your point of view, what are some of the things that have happened over, let's say, the last year in that whole arena that you think are most important for docs in practice to know about?
There are several aspects that are very important for physicians in clinical practice. What we have seen is that the EGFR antibodies, cetuximab and panitumumab, that they are active in chemorefractory metastatic colorectal cancer. There is clearly an impact in this setting, but probably one of the most important advances in regard to this topic and in regard to the management of colorectal cancer is that we have learned that the activity is confined to the wild-type KRAS patients. There are now data published in literature in this group of patients, so in chemorefractory patients, from more than 800 patients, coming from different studies that tell us that when a patient has a KRAS mutant status, that there is virtually no chance of having any benefit from panitumab or cetuximab. That does not mean that all patients with a non-mutated or wild-type KRAS tumor will respond, but the activity is confined to the wild-type KRAS tumor. So, and that's important because that will help physicians to tailor their treatment better. That will help us to avoid to treat any patients in whom we know that there will be no benefit with cetuximab or panitumab because they have a KRAS mutant tumor. So we will not treat these patients. We will not expose them to treatment with panitumab or cetuximab. I do think that's very important. And also at this meeting, at this GI Cancer Symposium meeting, we have seen data from different studies in chemorefractory patients. Whether this holds also true in the first-line setting, that's not yet clear. We don't have yet any data from large trials in the first-line setting that report on benefit and the difference in wild-type versus mutant tumor. So,
do you think we're going to have that? I mean, you have your study. Are you looking at it there?
Yes, we will report on this in the near future. We plan to report on that at ASCO. We have submitted an abstract for ASCO.
And overall, roughly, what fraction of colorectal cancers are KRAS mutant?
Approximately 40% of all tumors are KRAS mutant, and 60% of all tumors are wild-type KRAS.
Now, is there a commercially available assay for this that a clinician can order it?
The methodology is not easy, but it can be done. There are several commercially available tests available. The most used test and the best test is based on a PCR test. There are some aspects on quality control, quality assurance, so not all labs will be able to do it, so there will be a small learning curve also. But that's like with HER2 testing in patients with breast cancer. Once we show that we can select a patient for response or resistance, like with trastuzumab in breast cancer, physicians and the labs will organize themselves because the difference is big. If you look, for instance, and again speaking in the wild-type chemorefractory patients, if you look at the response rate with panitumab single agent, in all patients is 10%. In patients with a KRAS mutant tumor, there were no responses. In patients with a wild-type KRAS, the response rate was 17%. So the difference is high. If you look at the combination cetuximab irinotecan, also, if you look at the initial reported BOND study, the response rate in irinotecan refractory patients treated with irinotecan plus cetuximab was 23%. If you look at the different studies, retrospective analysis, but they are very consistent in all different studies, the response rate in the wild-type KRAS tumors after treatment with cetuximab plus irinotecan is in the order of 30 to 40%. So that's already consistent. And we're speaking of a population in chemorefractory. So we can really enrich the population.
Although, again, from a practical point of view of a clinician, it doesn't sound like it's that clear that the, you know, so the laboratory reliability, et cetera, is kind of set right now that you could make a decision on it.
I do think that the laboratory setting is that labs that do the testing and that have all the process in place, and that's not limited to a selected number of academic centers. That's not the case. There are more difficult tests.
So you think it's reasonable to actually do the test now?
Yes, and if you look even in Europe, EMEA, the equivalent of FDA, has granted approval for panitumab only to the patients with a wild-type KRAS tumor. So, and in Europe, we have to stick more to the label. In Europe, we will not be able to prescribe panitumab to a patient with a RAS-mutated tumor, so we have to test it.
So, for example, for an oncologist in the United States right now, is there a lab or a website that you say, I think these people do the test reliably?
I can't answer.
You think there are some?
There are some, yes.
Okay.
Speaking with my U.S. colleagues, I hear that, and that's for the last 3 to 6 months, that everybody is organizing
right.
Themselves, and that they tell me that within somewhere this year, most of the places will be organized that if they don't do the test in their own
right.
place, that they can find a lab where they can send the
right.
test to. And we will have to do it. It's not only economically, but also for the patient benefit. It's much better to do it.
I guess also the issue, and I was talking to Alan Vanook yesterday, you know, about the trials that are ongoing right now that are using these agents. Are the eligibility going to have to be revised?
Some of the trials have done that, as was communicated also at this meeting. In some of the trials, like some of the trials in first line and second line of chemo, FOLFOX plus or minus panitumab in first line, and then the second line trial also, chemo plus or minus panitumab, there was a protocol amendment. Sample size has been recalculated in order to meet potential benefit in the group of patients with the wild-type KRAS. So the trials have been amended, yes.
Has this been looked at in other tumors, for example, head and neck?
To my knowledge, I am not aware of any data in head and neck where it has been looked at.
Do you think it should be?
I think there is a good reason to do that.
Sounds
also.
Like it.
Yeah, there is a good reason
I
to
mean,
do
yeah.
that. But I'm not treating myself head and neck
right.
cancers, but I don't see a reason why these physicians or people who have done these trials should not look at it.
I mean,
tumor.
You know, it's nice to have people be able to avoid a therapy
yeah.
that's not going to work.
Yeah, sure.
You know, say HER2, ER, same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Any sort of gut feeling that you have right now in terms of the relative efficacy of panitumumab and cetuximab?
We don't have head-to-head comparisons of cetuximab and panitumab. If we look at the data that we do have in cross-trial comparisons of monotherapy, single agent, in chemo-refractory patients, and cetuximab or panitumab in chemo-refractory patients, the response rate is very similar. It's around 10% if you look at the different trials. With cetuximab, we have more data on combination with chemo. So that's why many physicians and why when I treat today a patient in a chemo-refractory setting, we prefer to use the combination and we use for the combination cetuximab plus irinotecan because we do have more data on combination treatment. But if you look just in cross-trial comparisons, the response rate is very similar for both drugs.
So I kind of want to ask you the same question as it relates to bevacizumab. What are some of the things that have happened in the last year that you think are most important for a doc in practice to know in terms of bevacizumab?
Bevacizumab, the data are, let's say, a bit older. And what is important, I think, is what many people have been doing already, is that we have seen the last year also data on oxaliplatin-based treatment that bevacizumab in a formal randomized trial in the first line increases the activity of oxaliplatin-based treatment. We knew that already from the second line, the ECOG study, FOLFOX plus or minus bevacizumab, that was positive. We knew from the first line that when bevacizumab was combined with 5-FU, that it increased the activity, or when combined with irinotecan 5-FU. So the picture is becoming formally evidence-based, more complete, and actually that's the reason why also the European authorities formally are extending the label. Until a week ago, we had in Europe only a label with bevacizumab when linked to irinotecan-based therapy because
right.
that was formerly looked at. Now, since this week, the label has expanded.
Interesting.
So that's one important aspect. A second aspect we are discussing a lot about, where we don't have formal answer but only suggestions, is what about the continuation of bevacizumab after progression? We have seen the data from the BRIGHT study presented last year at ASCO, where it is suggested, not proven, but suggested that in a patient that is progressive on chemo plus bevacizumab, that when we switch the chemo and continue bevacizumab, that in this group of patients, the outcome was better. It's not a randomized trial, but the data point out, as well as some preclinical data in this direction, that continuation of bevacizumab might benefit at least a group of patients. We need a formal comparison in this setting. So that's one.
And I guess that's going to happen in terms of at least one study is the IBET study.
The IBET study.
Are there any others?
In Europe, the IBET study is in the startup phase and is recruiting until now not very well, if I understand it from my American colleagues. In Europe, a German group is doing a similar type of study where there is a bit more flexibility in that sense that patients can be treated with any irinotecan or oxaliplatin-based treatment in the first line, plus bevacizumab, and then they just change in the second line to the other chemo, to the other backbone chemo, plus or minus bevacizumab. That trial is recruiting relatively fast in Germany, but it's a smaller trial than the IBET. So this trial will have some indications also.
Do you think there's a rational biological explanation for this?
Yes, if you look at some of the preclinical data in xenografts, we see that there is a rationale. And then also, there are some data that when you stop an anti-VEGF, such as bevacizumab, that the VEGF levels increase. Whether that's correlated with faster tumor growth in humans, that's not yet clear. But we see at least that the VEGF level increases dramatically, so that there's a kind of rebound in human beings.
And in the sera.
In the serum, yes, the VEGF levels in the serum. And then we have some preclinical data from xenografts that also there is a faster growth after stopping exposure to bevacizumab, but that's xenograft data.
Anything new in terms of potential markers of response or resistance to Bev?
Not really. Most of the studies are negative. There are some limited data of Pines Lenz group, I believe, on polymorphism, but no real application, and a lot of progress has to be made. And we are a bit less optimistic than for the EGFR inhibitors that we will be able to find for bevacizumab or other angiogenesis inhibitors, at least at short term, some markers, some predictive markers. But having said that, we should prepare everything and collect at least blood, if possible, and also tumor blocks in the trials to see if one day, and I don't think we should be pessimistic, if one day there comes suggestion of a marker so that we can validate it rapidly based on the trials that we have been doing.
There's a lot of controversy in a whole bunch of tumors, breast, lung, colon, renal, ovary, about mechanism of action of bevacizumab. What's your sort of gut feeling about that? And do you think that it's going to be effective in the adjuvant setting?
Of course, a formal answer in the adjuvant setting. Two large trials are finished. The US NSABP trial is a two-arm trial, FOLFOX versus FOLFOX bevacizumab. And then in the rest of the world, Europe and other continents, we have done the AVANT trial, which is a three-arm trial, FOLFOX versus FOLFOX bevacizumab versus capecitabine oxaliplatin bevacizumab. This was more than 3,000 patients. The two-arm trial of the NSCPP was more than 2,000 patients. There is indeed a lot of controversy, and we don't clearly understand all aspects of the mechanism of action of bevacizumab. A concept and a dogma that is often proposed and presented is that an angiogenesis inhibitor will work more in less advanced tumors. So therefore, there is a good reason to believe that it might work in the adjuvant setting, but we don't have data. On the other hand, some of the opponents say if you have only a few cells that are implanted, how can tumor vessel growth play an important role in only a few cells? And how can an antibody against circulating VEGF in this setting have an extra effect? There's a lot of controversy on this topic, so the proof will come from the randomized trials. And then I hope in the meantime we will learn also more on the mechanism of action.
Anything else new with Bev?
Another aspect where we're a lot of discussion is ongoing is, does Bev play a role in the neoadjuvant setting of patients with initially unresectable metastasis? In other words, can we increase the resection and rate in patients with initially non-resectable metastasis with Bev? If you look at the data and some of the important communications for physicians and some important lessons, the first question is, can a patient be operated safely after the administration of bevacizumab? We have learned from different studies, study presented at the GI Cancer Symposium last year from MD Anderson, two cohorts, patients treated with chemo and patients treated with chemo plus Bev, that there were not more complications when these patients underwent liver surgery. That's not randomized. There were two cohorts from MD Anderson. Then we are looking also in different studies, like for instance the BEAT, which is a non-US or European-Asian expanded access and South American expanded access program of Bev, a bit similar than the BRIGHT. There we have been looking also at the patients that underwent resection or surgery, and more than 100 patients of the 2,000 patients underwent surgery. And it seems that surgery can be done safely. at least if surgery is done 6 weeks after the last administration of BEV. So that's the recommendation today, to wait 6 weeks after the last administration of BEV because of the long half-life of bevacizumab. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is the real question on efficacy. Does chemo plus BEV lead to more liver resections than chemo alone? We have some data from the Roche trial presented by Lance Holtz and Jim Cassidy that suggest it's an exploratory analysis, so it was not pre-planned, but that suggests at least that slightly more patients can undergo liver resection when treated with 5-FU or capecitabine plus oxaliplatin plus BEV compared to the arm without bevacizumab. So it might be in this setting that it might influence. At the ERTC, we're doing also an interesting study at the moment, a study in patients with resectable liver metastasis. So building upon the experience of the study presented last year at ASCO in resectable liver metastasis of perioperative FOLFOX versus surgery alone, what we are doing right now is a randomized phase 2 study, two arms, the concept of perioperative chemo, so 3 months before and 3 months after the operation in all patients with resectable metastasis, but then we are randomizing the patients between FOLFOX cetuximab or FOLFOX cetuximab bevacizumab.
Wow.
To look at, let's say it's randomized phase 2, to look at feasibility, at safety, and to prepare this hopefully for a randomized phase 3 against FOLFOX, to take the best arm and then compare that with FOLFOX.
What about BEV alone?
For different reasons, there is no BEV alone arm, but optimally this would have to be a randomized phase 2 with 3 arms, FOLFOX BEV,
right,
FOLFOX cetuximab versus FOLFOX cetuximab BEV. But for different reasons and resources, we had to select to limit it to a randomized phase 2 with 2 arms to try to select which one is the best.
I mean, I've heard about people trying that combination even off study. First of all, do you think that that's something that should ever be done, or do you think it should only be done on study?
I think today it should be done on study. We have seen some data being presented at the last ECHO meeting of the Dutch Cairo 2 study. The Dutch Cairo 2 study was a randomized study in first-line setting metastatic colorectal cancer, where patients were randomized between capecitabine, oxaliplatin, BEV plus cetuximab, so the two biologicals. We don't have yet any efficacy, but the Dutch group has presented the safety of the 400 patients, also a considerable number of patients, and have shown that if you look at all adverse events, there were slightly more adverse events in the 4-drug arm than in the 3-drug arm. But if we exclude the skin rash, which is attributed to cetuximab, of course, there was no difference in the adverse events rate. So the conclusion of this safety analysis in the first 400 patients, as presented at the last ECHO meeting in Barcelona, was that this combination is safe in the hands of the Dutch group. And the US CLGB is also doing a randomized first-line study of chemo dealer's choice plus BEV, or the chemo plus cetuximab, or chemo plus both antibodies. More than 2,000 patients are planned. Today, more than 1,000 patients are on the trial. The information that has been disclosed is that the IDMC is looking at regular time points in view of the safety problems with the combination bevacizumab panitumab plus chemo. So in this US CLGB study, the IDMC didn't come up with safety concerns until now. And also in the ERTC study, to go back to that topic, we are monitoring very closely the safety aspects. And I've treated several patients today also in the framework of this ERTC study for FOLFOX BEV plus cetuximab. There is not really safety concern until today. But having said that, I would not advise today to treat outside of a protocol until we have efficacy data, patients with 2 cytotoxics plus 2 biologicals together in the first line. The sequential use today is the standard outside of a protocol, so chemo plus BEV in the first line, and then later on in failing patients, an EGFR inhibitor.
Now, inpatients are getting this 4-drug combination prior to hepatic surgery. When does the chemo and the cetuximab stop relevant to the surgery?
The chemo and the cetuximab are stopped 4 weeks before surgery, but BEV is not given 6 weeks before. So what we do, in fact, is five cycles of FOLFOX cetuximab BEV, and then we give a sixth cycle of FOLFOX cetuximab, and we delete during that sixth cycle BEV, so that we can do the liver surgery 4 weeks after the chemo and cetuximab, but 6 weeks after BEV.
Now, you mentioned the PACE study. Does it seem that panitumumab does not combine as well with BEV as cetuximab?
It's a big mystery. We don't have a clear answer why the PACE study was negative. The most likely hypothesis with the information that we do have today is that there was clearly an excess toxicity in the FOLFOX BEV panitumumab arm, and the inferior activity, as far as we know, can possibly be attributed to an increased toxicity. Why there was increased toxicity, that's a mystery. An hypothesis, but it's only an hypothesis, is that there's a kind of interaction between BEV and panitumumab when combined with chemo, because of the stronger binding capacity of panitumumab that is not found when chemo is given with BEV and cetuximab. Having said that, the next logic question is, what about chemo plus panitumumab? We didn't see yet a lot of data in this regard, but at this meeting there is a poster looking at safety of chemo plus panitumumab, suggesting, and also according to communications of the IDMC, that there is no concern of toxicity. But we didn't see the details of the data yet. We really have to see the details of data of chemo plus panitumumab versus chemo alone to answer this question formally.
Now, what about the question of doing an adjuvant trial looking at, you know, FOLFOX, BEV, and cetuximab?
I don't think we are ready for that. I think before we can plan that, we need a bit more insight in the ongoing adjuvant trials, the two bevacizumab trials and the two cetuximab trials that are running, FOLFOX plus or minus cetuximab. One is running in the US, one is running in Europe in the ERTC PETAC structure. So the ERTC, the PETAC study is running very fast. We will end recruitment before summer this year.
Are there other data that you think are important to see before, again, an adjuvant trial would come out? Or is there anything that you're expecting over the next year or two trials that you think will mature that will help make the decision about whether a trial like this should go forward?
Yeah, I think the more insight in the history of the KRAS markers that we were discussing earlier, until now the data that we do have on this KRAS story are in chemorefractory patients. The important question, and we will see very soon data, is this KRAS story as strong in the first line when patients are treated with FOLFOX, cetuximab, panitumumab, or with FOLFIRI, cetuximab, panitumumab? If that is also shown, then that's going to be important knowledge also to build in future strategies for adjuvant trials. Then you could think of an adjuvant trial in this enriched population, for instance. But a bit more insight in this story, in this emerging data, is needed.
You're talking about bevacizumab and the neoadjuvant pre-hepatic resection situation. What about bevacizumab in the neoadjuvant rectal cancer situation? We saw data initially, a few patients from Chris Willett kind of looking at the mechanism of action. MD Anderson started to look at it. Do you think that's heading anywhere?
A difficult question also, and the first question that has to be solved is, can it be safely done? Until now in rectal cancer, there are a couple of reports of a bit increased toxicity, but the majority of data still tell us that it probably can be done safely. Several groups are planning. We actually have developed a protocol in rectal cancer that we will start very soon, that is ready as an investigator-initiated protocol, where we will randomize patients between, in the neoadjuvant setting, radiotherapy, capecitabine, bevacizumab, followed by surgery, versus radiotherapy, capecitabine, oxaliplatin, bevacizumab. So what we will do is to look at the concept and at the feasibility and at the potential of combination of bevacizumab in combination with radio and with chemo and less and more intensive chemo. It's a randomized phase 2 study. We are not ready to implement that in trials, in randomized phase 3 trials, but exploration based on the data, the very interesting data of Chris Willett in small patients, it's very interesting and it has to be looked at. And again, that's what we plan also in our study, is to have a heavy translation research compound.
Right.
So what we will do is before starting the chemorad, we will administer one dose of BEV, take a biopsy before and after the BEV, before we start then with the chemorad, to try to understand better also, as Chris Willett did in his first study.
Interesting. Are you doing any other correlative studies, interstitial pressure, anything like that?
No. We plan to do, in this study, biopsies. We collect serum. In our center, we will do also DCI MRIs, but no interstitial fluid pressure.
You know, I guess we don't really know too much about the combination of BEV and radiation therapy. I know in non-small cell lung cancer, they're about to launch a trial that's a very cautious trial looking at chemo, BEV, and the stage 3 chemo radiation setting, but I guess it's kind of hard to speculate in terms of what radiation therapy does to the vasculature, what BEV does, and what's going to happen. What do you think?
Yeah, we don't know. That's why I said that we are not ready to implement that in phase 3 studies. I think these studies have to be carefully done by an experienced group of investigators, where as much as possible correlative studies are also integrated, and where also we look at safety aspects carefully in rectal cancer, as is done also in pancreatic cancer, for instance, by Chris Crane and his group in MD Anderson. So step by step, we have to look into that. But despite the fact that we can control many patients with local control to rectal cancer patients with optimal surgery in combination with chemoradiotherapy, unfortunately, still many patients will develop metastasis. So one of the aims is to try to improve on that with the combined modality treatment option.
And I guess if the adjuvant trials are positive, we're going to be a lot more excited about doing that.
Correct.